Good morning, family. Trudy did an incredible job just now. That's why we were in the back trying to figure out what was going on. She just blew our minds away. So, thanks, Trudy. Sorry, let me put this on. Great. Cool. Good morning, family. How you guys doing? Can I just say that I am extremely, extremely happy to be here in Baltimore. This coming Friday is 3 years to the day that Hannah and I moved from New York here. 3 years this Friday. And I'm extremely, extremely grateful for that. You guys literally saw everything. I mean, we moved here the day after we got engaged. So you saw our entire engagement process. You saw our newlywed stage. You saw and supported us through Hannah's pregnancy. Now you've ignored me and all your focus is on Lucas, which is the way it works, and I'm appreciative of that. This is a family, and I am extremely, extremely grateful to be part of it. Now, on the topic of family, last Sunday was an incredible, incredible moment in my life. I feel like I've been waiting for years to experience LeBron James winning. Bringing the Cleveland Cavaliers to the promised land. It was very moving for me, and it's just one of those like, wow, I'm so grateful that I'm around to experience such a wonderful occasion. I told Hannah, you know, that I don't want anything for Father's Day. I feel like, you know, I really do feel like fatherhood is the gift, and I'm very grateful for Lucas. I'm very grateful for Hannah. I don't need anything, but if God wanted to put icing on the cake, then, you know, LeBron Gay in a ring in the Cleveland would be incredible. You know, God does answer his prayers, guys. So thanks for everyone else that prayed for that as well. So at that game seven, of the Warriors against the Cleveland Cavaliers, there was a man that spent $116,000 on two courtside seats. $116,000 on two basketball tickets. Now, as was said in the welcome, today is a day that we're going to be collecting our special missions. Our goal was given by this one guy. The goal we're trying to reach to help change lives around the world was this one PayPal transaction. Not PayPal. StubHub. Thanks, guys. One StubHub transaction. Now, granted, these were the best seats in the house. These were the seats. I mean, you're on the court. Your feet are actually on the same court that LeBron James is going to win his ring on. And it's a valuable, this is a hot ticket. And you will be on TV. You will get, whenever you want, well, not whenever you want, during like halftime, pregame, postgame, you can actually get on the court and walk around. Part of the ticket is that the court kind of belongs to you as well, as long as you don't interrupt the game. And there's also websites that people look up, hey, who was courtside on whatever, and your name and information will come up. Like, you're a big deal if you have these very, very expensive tickets. Now, best seats in the house, and I think for any basketball fan, that would be where we want it to be. You know, because there are more expensive seats at these stadiums. There are the box suites that are way away from the game. You're not really supposed to watch the game from those seats. You eat and have business meetings, and you listen to the crowd and the regular, you know, normal people enjoying the game. So they're more expensive, but they're not actually for fans. The fan wants to have these best seats in the house. Now, Jesus had a very, very different understanding and teaching of what the best seat in the house is. We're going to be continuing with our study on parables. We're going to be reading from the Gospel of Luke in chapter 14. And we're going to be talking about pride. We're going to be talking about pride. Luke 14, best seats in the house. I almost never title my sermons, but I came up with this title that I think someone should write a book. Boom. It just sounds really good, right? Pride and Prejudice? Copyright, man, immediately. It's a good title. So, Luke, that's a real book. That's a real book. Okay, great. It exists already. Luke 14, from verse 1. It says, "One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. There in front of him was a man suffering from an abnormal swelling of his body, or it could be dropsy in your text. Jesus asked the Pharisees and the experts in the law, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?' But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent them on his way. Then he asked them, 'If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out?' And they had nothing to say. When he noticed how the guests picked their places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have already been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, 'Give this person your seat.' Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important seat. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, 'Friend, move up to a better place.' Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." So, the buildup to this parable is extremely convicting, and I feel silly that I think ignored it in my trying to figure out what to say today. Now, the Pharisees, as they did very frequently, were trying to trap Jesus any opportunity, any means they could. And here was another chance. Here's this guy with dropsy or the swelling. Now, like it says there, dropsy is another term for edema, right? Abe, that's the condition. Edema, E-D-E-M-A, which is a medical condition that's just like you have fluid buildup that primarily will gather around your ankles and wrist, and it would be seen as a physical like skin surface abnormality. Now, this would have meant that you were ceremonially unclean. Now, the Pharisees, who had monopolized righteousness, so that they're and then in their holier than thou attitude, were watching Jesus to see, okay, how is he going to respond to this situation that we can use as ammunition to say that, oh, he's not at all who he says he is, because if you're really this holy, righteous guy, you're not going to touch that unclean thing. And so they were trying to figure out how to get him. Now, Jesus, so slick, right? So genius in the way he responds here. He's like, hey guys, I know today is the Sabbath. I was actually there when the Sabbath was invented. But you know, who's keeping track, right? I got a question for you. Is it wrong for someone to heal someone else on this day of divinely inspired but Pharisee perverted day of rest? Because if you say no, then you lose the popular vote, and people will see that, oh, they actually don't. Because the Pharisees were all about looking good in front of people. But now if you say no to this question, then it's like, oh, well, I thought you guys cared about us. But if you say yes, then you're breaking your own ridiculous, silly, self-righteous rules. So, like, congratulations, you played yourself, you know? Another one. So, Jesus, boom, is like, okay, cool, I got you. And then, what do you guys think? They have no response. So then Jesus heals this guy, and then ask them again, well, if you leave your car on neutral on a hill and your kid is you forget your kid in the car seat in the back of the car, and it's a Sabbath, you will do work, right, to prevent your kid from rolling down the hill, right, guys? And, well, silence. So Jesus, well, I thought so. You don't have an answer for that. And another thing, after he takes their plan and just like, got you, and now you look silly, and now that, I mean, while we're at it, I see the way you guys picked your seats in this room. Let me teach you something real quick. Now, this wasn't necessarily a harsh rebuke or a correction for correction's sake, but he's actually teaching them what it means to really be righteous. So first he heals this man, just like that, boom, removes the outward skin, surfacey, materialistic, visual, humanistic view here's that layer, healed, miracle, boom, right there, and then turns to everyone else in the room who are internally unclean, internally unclean, whose hearts are impure, and whose souls are destined for eternal damnation, and then gives them, just like he healed this guy, gives them instructions to how to be internally pure as well. Then it hit me that this is not just a miracle. This is not just a parable. Jesus spent 3 years healing the sick, raising the dead, cleansing the impure, not just to fix those individuals' lives or highlight the fact that he could do it, but to open the audience to accept his spiritual healing as well. And that's how that translates and resonates to us today. When we look at these examples of Jesus' miracles, they serve as a reminder of his purifying power to our spiritual lives today. Jesus can heal the sick and the sick in heart. He can raise the dead and give hope and purpose to those who have a buried, decrepit faith. He can cleanse the impure physically and rid you of all your guilt and shame and dirt and sin through contact and communication with his saving grace. But you know what gets in the way of that? Our pride. He can do these miracles. He's shown that he can do it. And then he says, okay, the outside stuff is great, but I can fix your insides. I can fix where you stand before God. But our pride gets in the way of that, and we don't see it because pride will make you blind. The Pharisees, pride made them blind. Now, let's define pride today as just thinking of yourself higher than others. Thinking of yourself higher than how you understand that other people think. And now Jesus then fits into that category of others. So you're thinking of yourself higher than Jesus. And then pride will make you blind. Two years ago, Hannah and I were driving from Baltimore to New York, which is without traffic, about a three-hour, 45-minute drive. And we left pretty late. I want to say we left at like 9 p.m., thinking that we can get there either at midnight, right before midnight, and have a full day of work and then go. About 2 hours in, 2 hours into the drive, Hannah was like, "Hey, can we get some hot chocolate?" "Yeah, of course. You know, you're my wife. I can put up the chocolate. $1.17. Yes, let's get some hot chocolate." So I take out the GPS, put in Dunkin' Donuts. It doesn't take off the track too much because that would be ridiculous. So like right off, cool. Dunkin' Donuts, great. You like your hot chocolate, babe? Good, great. Good husband. Good job. Let's go. Happy wife, happy life. So then I GPS, after we get the Dunkin' Donuts, and then put home in the GPS, and then keep going to what I thought was New York. We've been driving for 2 hours. An hour passes. Things are looking very familiar. So I'm like, oh, great. You know, we're on the right track. Hour 15, hour and a half. And Hannah says, "Hey, babe, are we going the right way?" Are we going the right way? You think you can ask me, are we going the right way? I'm the driver here. You just sit there. You know? I'm the driver. You'll be sitting in the back of the car when I'm finished with you. Are we going the right? You can't ask me that. Now, little did I know, we were now recrossing the Delaware Bridge on the way back to Pikesville, Maryland, which is not Long Island, New York. My pride made me very, very blind. Now, it added, is that baby laughing at me? Wow, that's crazy. Wow. So, this added almost 4 hours to our trip. And we got home, like, with the sun rising. It was really bad. But Jesus saw the Pharisees' callous hearts and tells them this parable. Now, family, yes, he's talking to the Pharisee and his guest. But I imagine the message to us would be very similar. In verse 7 of Luke 14, it says, when he noticed how the guests picked their places in the honor of the table, he told them this parable. Now, for years, I thought this was Jesus was in the room, and people were trying to get a spot next to him, kind of like how his apostles did a little bit after. Well, I want to be on your right, I want to be on your left. So I always assumed that this idea of place of honor was Jesus was looking at the guys on his left and right and said, you don't want this spot, you want to be further away and then come to me. But remember, we just read that Jesus just heals this guy from dropsy. Now, the guy with dropsy in the Pharisee's house, the only spot that he would have been allowed to be is right outside the door. And it says that he was in front of Jesus. So Jesus and this dropsy guy are within eye contact from each other, which is not the high honor place of this room at all. Actually, the high place would be the place furthest away from the door so that when you enter, everybody can see you, like those courtside tickets. The people were fighting over a spot next to the Pharisee. They were like, well, based on my righteousness compared to the Pharisee and everyone in this room, where do I stand? And they completely ignored the fact that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, was there amongst them. But all they were thinking of is, who am I more righteous than in this room? What have I done on my spiritual resume that will allow me a seat next to the Pharisee? The guy, the sinful, corrupt human guy. Ridiculous, but a 2016 problem as well. Verse 8 says, Jesus explains to them. Now, again, Jesus explained it to the group that is not even focused. So they after they failed at getting him to mess up with the dropsy guy, now they're still in their very, very prideful, very arrogant, very self-righious way of thinking, okay, we're next, how close are we to the most righteous person in the house, being the Pharisee? When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor for someone more distinguished than you may have been invited. Now, the imagery here is very clear. The Pharisees, actually, most people in this time, this was what they call shame culture, that you would literally make decisions based on what brings you the least amount of shame. Like, how can I exalt myself at the absolute maximum here? So this is a very embarrassing, shameful situation to be told, hey, you're not as important as you think you are. Can you please go sit somewhere else? This would be, I mean, when Jesus tells them this parable, they would feel very uncomfortable because the people that are sitting next to the Pharisee are probably thinking, well, he's talking about me, and he's probably saying that I'm not important. And that would be very, very shameful. Now, I've experienced something. There's going to be a lot of embarrassing stories about myself because talking about pride, I figured that like this is practice for me. Another time in New York, which seems to be the place of all of my humiliation. Time in New York, Sunday afternoon, I'd actually just finished preaching from what I was told was a good sermon. So I was kind of on that. Okay, I did good today. We went to the mall with some of the campus students. I think I told some people this already. Went to the mall with some of the campus students, and Busta Rhymes shows up in the mall. Now, backstory is I know Busta Rhymes because his son was on my basketball team, on the basketball team that I was on. We went to the same school. I'd actually got a chance to hang out with him outside of school. We had the same barber, so I know on a personal level Busta Rhymes. At least I thought that's our relationship. So I'm with, now there's Hannah there, so I'm obviously trying to impress her and some other guys. And then we see Busta Rhymes walk in front of the store we were in, and everyone's like, oh man, it's Busta Rhymes. I'm like, oh, come on guys. That's my man, Busta Rhymes. So I run out, and I'm like, hey, Busta, that, you know, like that's my guy. And he didn't respond, so I say it louder, and I'm walking quicker towards him, and his security guard out of nowhere, like LeBron blocking Andre Iguodala, like out of nowhere, just grabs my throat and is like, hey man, back off. He's with his kids. I'm like, you know what? You don't know me, but Busta Rhymes knows me. So this is even better, because not only am I going to get a chance to, you know, show that I know him, now you're going to look crazy for preventing me from having this reunion with my friend Busta Rhymes. Okay, Bus, Mr. Rhymes. And he looked at me, and I'm like, boom, this is it. This is the eye contact. This is the moment. This is my championship ring moment right here. And just, nope, and keeps it moving. Now, not only was I humiliated in front of him and his kids and his security guard and the people that were there with me, but we're in the public mall, and I was screaming Busta Rhymes at this point. So I thought very highly of myself until this man put his hand on my throat. Jesus says that your choices are be humble or be humbled. Those are your choices. You can either take the place of, I am so grateful to be in the presence of Jesus. I am so grateful to be part of this church. Or I deserve X, Y, and Z for what I have accomplished and for my level of righteousness. One of those gets you exalted. The other one gets you put down. Church, too often, we live lives of repeated unrepentant sin, lukewarm commitment, selfishness, and pride, and somehow we figure out a way to believe that because of the church we go to, or the doctrine we believe, or for whatever reason it is, we have this justified arrogance that, oh, me and God are great. Me and God are cool. I don't follow his commands. I don't live a humble life. But only he can judge me and we're fine, so I'm good. You know, back off. He's with his kids. You know, the passage, God opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble, right? That word opposes, opposition, is very much a military terminology. It's like God makes an enemy of those that are prideful and gives grace to the humble. Now what that means, because you get grace because you messed up. So when you're humble, even though you messed up, God looks at you and says, you know what, I'll give you grace. But when you're prideful and you mess up, he treats you as you deserve, which is not a position that any of us should want to be in. Let's look at Philippians 2. Philippians 2 from verse 1. It says, therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united in Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same, like-minded, having being one in spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but to the interests of others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who in very nature God did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Let's keep it right there. So Paul reminds the church in Philippi, hey, be humble. Be humble. Remember Jesus. Remember his death. Remember what he did. Now, in your Bibles or even phones, you'll see that the letter goes from regular Bible writing to Proverbs, Psalm kind of poetry breakdown, because this was most likely a song. This was most likely a poem that when the church in Philippi gets this letter and they're reading it, they would all start singing together because they understand. I mean, you know, when you're trying to memorize something, you make a song out of it. This is the kind of humility is the kind of thing that we need to have on straight all the time. And I just think that the fact that this is pushed in and made a poem, I think by itself is very telling to what the author Paul and the audience, that the value that they gave that they gave a humility. Now, it says in verse 7, he made himself nothing. He emptied himself of all that was perfect about him and took on all that was messed up about humanity. Can you imagine that Jesus probably sprained his ankle? Like, he probably stubbed his toe and experienced pain. He probably got a stomach bug. Like, he had to learn social norms. You know how ridiculous that is? He made all of this stuff. You know, it's like if somehow I was able to transfer all of my knowledge and experience of 25 years into my son Lucas. So now Lucas, this floppy, drooly baby, has all of this information in his head but can't do anything with it and has to, like, learn how to walk and learn how to swallow mashed bananas. I can do more than this, but I mean that humility that it would take to exist in this watered down shell of who you actually are is incredible. Now, Jesus has to make a way bigger downgrade than any of us would have to, and that's the example. Now, we don't have divine residence in heaven that we have to empty ourselves of. We don't have a oneness with God as something that we have to empty ourselves of. But we do have personal biases, prejudiced feelings, unhealthy political allegiances, and let's be honest, sometimes racial preferences that exist inside us. Humility, emptying oneself, means these things can't matter anymore. These things are no longer important in who you are as a person. That's very tough. That's very hard because we so badly want to be. We want to stand for something. I have this take on this situation. You can't tell me otherwise. Jesus had all the reason in the world to hold on to stuff like that, but he let it go. So when we decide that our personal preferences about things are more valuable than striving for the type of humility that Jesus did, it looks ridiculous. It doesn't make sense, but we justify it because pride will make you blind. So answer these in your head. If the answer, these are 100% yes or no. There's no in between, and if you start trying to find in between, well, that you're answering the question already. Does someone need to be on your level to correct you about something? Does someone need to be in the exact same stage of life successful to call something out about your character? I've gotten better at this, but there was a time that it would drive me crazy when people would come and, like, try and adjust my bow tie, and I would look down and see that your belt and socks don't match. Why are you trying to help me? You're wearing suspenders and a belt. How can you help me in this situation? Now, I've gotten better, and if you're wearing a suspenders and belt today, free lesson, you don't need both. And you really want to make sure your socks and your belt match in color. Okay. But, you know, humorous fashion. Hey, you're not a parent. You can't give me advice. You don't have kids. You don't have kids at this age. You can't give me input. You haven't been through what I've been through. How dare you try and? If you have thought this, check off yes. Do you have an answer prepared while someone is correcting you on something? Do you formulate rationale? Okay, here's what I'm going to say that sounds like humility, but it's really just going to justify what I've done. Have you ever had a friendship damaged because of how you responded to being corrected? Does it seem like people have to walk around broken glass to correct you about things? Do you normally get things your way? Do you get angry and mean and vengeful when things do not go your way? Do you have a hard time asking for help? Do you feel like if it's in my heart, I have to say it? If you, this is building up in me. I have to say it. I'm unable to just sit on some of my thoughts. Do you interrupt people while they speak? Any of these things, and this was my list of stuff for me. So, any of these things are proof that there is a pride issue that needs to be taken care of. Jesus lowers himself, takes on this position of humility, and says we have to do the same. When you're prideful, not only will it make you blind, pride will make you forget Christ crucified. Pride will make you blind, and it will make you forget Christ crucified. Because if he had to suffer, if he had to bring himself down, we're crazy to think that we can float above other people in our pride. Last passage as we close, Psalm 51. Psalm 51, we're going to read from verse 17. Yes. It says, "My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. You, God, will not despise." Now, I've had for most of my life a very hard time understanding what it means to be broken. I think what I had seen, or what I'd understood, was that brokenness means you have to feel miserable. It's like, bro, are you broken about your sin? I'm like, okay, I think so. But I think what you're asking, and this is all in my mind. What you're asking me to be is to be miserable and be sad and like be and pity and like, oh, woe is me. And that's just not the way that I think. Literally just means, because this is even reading this passage, like, okay, a broken heart. Broke and contrite literally just means crushed, like pulverized, made into powder. It's like I don't always feel like when you look at the cross and we take communion, I don't feel miserable. And then I started to think maybe I'm doing this wrong. I mean, maybe there's supposed to be this kind of misery. And what someone else actually explained that helped me a ton was that if you look at brokenness like, if you give a conscience to a broken toaster, the toaster is broken. The toaster understands its brokenness. The toaster can see that, man, if I try and make this work, I'm going to fail. The toaster knows that it needs outside help to make it work. The toaster is very aware that if it pridefully tries to chug through stuff, it can't happen. There's no misery there. It's just an understanding. I understand that I, on my own, cannot do anything. So are you broken about your sin? I understand that on my own, I'm stuck here forever. I can't, on my own, I cannot overcome this. Are you broken about what you've done? I understand that because of what I've done, Jesus has died and filled in the gaps that I can't fill myself. And I'm broken because I understand. Because it can't be a feeling. Because if brokenness is a feeling, then when you're happy, you're not broken. But if it's an understanding and a state of being that by yourself you can do nothing, that's Jesus had that heart. Crazy, because he could do stuff. He was able to do these things, but he decided to have a broken spirit. A brokenness that's without God, I am nothing. And he was God. And us, who are not God, need to understand that this brokenness, we need to be there as well. Not misery, not self-pity, not this sorrow that's just, oh my gosh, I'm such a terrible person. Just understand that by yourself, you're nothing. Now, what that should do is that should inspire the mess out of you to want to get Jesus. That should drive you to, I know that I don't work, so I need the power source that can make me work. That's motivating. That's driving. That's not just sitting and being sad about your situation. Now, Hannah and I, just like a week and a half ago, closed on our first house. And And now, actually, Catonsville is going to be home for us. So, you know, 21228 is our new zip code. Now, actually, our realtor is here today. He helped a ton with the process. The truth is that his name's Tim. Give him many side hugs after service. The truth is, we don't get this house if it's not for Tim. Wouldn't happen. Now, on top of that, we will, and also who's here is Hannah's mom and kids from New York. The truth is, we don't get this house if Hannah's mom doesn't assist us financially pretty substantially. Truth is, we don't get this house without my dad's very, very frugal approach on how to make an offer on homes. Truth is, I don't use Tim if Fat doesn't suggest this specific route to go for purchasing a home. The truth is, without you guys' support, there's no way that I can make this happen. I'm now fully well aware in my stage of life that I can't actually afford this house by myself. I can't. Like, I on my own, I can't make this work. But all of these factors have not only made it possible, but made it what's actually happening. Because of these outside influences, now I have the privilege and the what's going to be the financial strain of owning a home. But I'm celebrating that. It's good news. I'm extremely excited. Where I fell short, where I wasn't able to do, so many other people came in and helped. When you realize that that's us spiritually, you actually can't maintain this level of righteousness by yourself. You need people. You need people to advise and direct and support and build you and lift you up when you're down. You need all of this stuff. And then on top of that, Jesus says, I got your back as well. When you realize that Jesus makes this available for us, you have no choice but to be humble. I can't brag about this house like I did it on my own. That's ridiculous. It's factually wrong. It's incorrect. That's not how it worked. It's not how it happened. I got help, assistance. I got a ton of support. And now we're here. Our righteousness cannot come from ourselves. Pride will make you blind. Pride will make you forget Christ crucified. So humility will help you see all of this. Humility will help you realize that, man, this is all possible because of Jesus and the people that he's put in my lives. Then, of course, you take the lower seat. Of course, you don't put yourself in a position, oh, look at me, look at what I've accomplished, look at what I've done. Give me credit. Give me acknowledgement. Of course, you take the humble position. Of course, when it comes to giving, your mindset is, this isn't even about me. This isn't about money. This is about putting myself on a looking at people's needs above mine and meeting that need financially. If you're visiting with us today, the charge is simple. Humble yourself. Now, what that's going to mean is that you may have come in here with preconceived ideas of what a relationship with God looks like. Now, at every stage of life, preconceived ideas are dangerous. Put down the shields, humble yourself, take the lower seat, and Jesus will exalt you. There's stuff that you just can't see in your pride that will be made very clear in your humility. If you're here and struggling in your faith, remember the joy that humility is supposed to bring. Remember the victory that humility, it's not a sad situation. It's a joyful understanding of where I fall short, Jesus can cover everything else. If you're here and you feel like you're doing great, be humble. Because you're probably not. A wise man said that things are never as bad or as good as you think they are, ever in life, ever. If you think things are terrible and you have no chance, it's not true. Through humility and the power of Jesus, you'll be fine. And if you think things are excellent, be careful. Not as a find ways to put yourself down, but remember who's in the room. Not a bunch of people, but Jesus. And that's the standard of righteousness that we have to be moving towards. So there is always, always room to grow. Let's not be like the guests and the Pharisees and those who don't see a need for change and see only a need for self-exaltation. But let's be humble. Let's actually take the lower seat so we can be exalted by God. We can be raised up in life, but also raised up to join him in heaven. Amen? Thank you guys very much.